was a, just a children. Yechiel Diener. This is a scene of Diener's testimony at the Eichmann trial. Diener was a famous novelist, survivor. He kept the picture of Rabbi Hagerman, the Jew, in the prayer shawl over his writing desk for years and years and years. Till one day his wife said, either the picture goes or I go. I can't stand looking at it anymore. But he says in the ghetto, there were no children. There were only big Jews and little Jews. But there were no children. I hesitate to share this with you, but it drives home the point. It's a short passage from a memoir by Sarah Nomberg-Czytek, Polish woman, Jewish woman sent to Auschwitz in the women's camp. The women's camp, if you've been to Birkenau, has anybody been to Birkenau? It's situated right across from the unloading platform where the trains were unloaded. So they could see and hear trains coming in. There were transports that consisted entirely of children sent to the camp. This is one of the recurring things in the Eichmann trial, if you read the testimony of the Eichmann trial. She relates that one night, she says, suddenly the stillness was broken by the screaming of children. A scream repeated 1,000 times in a single word, Mama. A scream that increased in intensity every second, enveloping the whole camp. Our lips parted without our being conscious of what we were doing, and a scream of despair tore out of our throats. And then all was silent. So that's one of the defining horrors of the Holocaust. This is not just, you know, children as casualties, but children as designated targets in order precisely to kill the soul. Fundamental to this assault.
Push to the right.
Is an assault on human relationship. The soul lives in the between space of human relationship. It's not inside of us, it's between us. One of the words for soul, neshama, means breath. So you draw the breath of the soul. The soul breathes in that midst of that relation. If you read Night, you recall near the end when Eliezer is looking for his father and one of the prisoners tells him, look, what are you doing? Don't you know where you are? Here there are no fathers. There are no sons. There are no friends. This is a realm, an anti-world, in which there are no fathers or sons or brothers or sisters or daughters and so on. As Primo Levi says in his memoir, Survival in Auschwitz, everyone is desperately and ferociously alone. Ferociously alone. This is a Primo Levi turn of phrase. He was a master at that. He also points out that for the Jews, the camp is not a punishment. The Jews are not sent to the camp because they've done anything. They haven't committed anything other than existing. So Levy describes what took place in Auschwitz as an anti-creation. It's the anti-creation of what he calls the non-man, the Muslim, which Emil Fackenheim describes as a unique product of National Socialism. The walking dead, the one who should be dead but isn't, the one who doesn't try to protect himself or herself when they're struck. The Muslim man doesn't eat. The Muslim man has no sex. You can't tell male from female, so I've been told. Primo Levi describes the Muslim man as the backbone of the camp. an anonymous mass continually renewed and always identical of non-men who march and labor in silence. The divine spark dead within them, already too far gone to suffer. One hesitates to call them living. One hesitates to call their death, death. See, death itself is obliterated in this realm. The Muslim man is the metaphysics of National Socialist anti-Semitism incarnate. The Muslim man is not somebody who is the victim of brutality and starvation and exposure. The Muslim man is the Jew who has had his or her name erased, who has seen his family murdered before his eyes, who has been forbidden to pray, who has seen his children taken away, etc. So, some of these defining features of the Holocaust, in my view, make it metaphysically, I don't know about unique, but singular. So metaphysical singularity about it, among historical events. I don't think it can be, this form of anti-Semitism, I don't think can be explained in cultural or anthropological, sociological, psychological terms, the usual terms. The unique horror of the Holocaust is that it was fundamentally an assault on the very principle that makes other horrors horrific, and not just matters of academic curiosity. It's an assault, it's a singular assault on the singular sanctity of the other human being. And it has implications for all of humanity. It's not just about the Jews. As Elie Wiesel famously said, what begins with the Jews doesn't end with the Jews. But why? Why doesn't it end with the Jews? Because it concerns a teaching not about who's Jewish, but what is the dearness of a human being. And another unusual feature of this event, graphically physical with metaphysical overtones, lies here in this. Some of you are old enough to remember April 26, 1986, Chernobyl, nuclear power plant in Ukraine. One day, you can see the chimney in the background on the left. A cloud of radioactive material goes into the atmosphere, one chimney one day. 2 weeks later, radiation levels in Montana were elevated. You perhaps have read that you can measure pollution on the planet by taking a plug of snow and ice from Antarctica. Antarctica. When we're speaking of the Holocaust, we're not speaking of one day and one chimney. We're talking about dozens of chimneys operating for 1,000 days, casting the body of Israel to the winds. The ashes of the people of Israel cover the earth from which we harvest our bread. They abide in the bread that we place in our mouths. This event covers the planet in ways that other horrific events don't. Not that other horrific events are not horrific. This is the black milk of daybreak. If you know Paul Celan's poem, A Death Fugue, he opens with the line, black milk of daybreak. The black milk is the ashen milk that we drink. So we become the graves of those who were denied a grave. And I think because of this, the fundamental first principles at stake here, in confronting this event, we come face to face with the first question put to the first human, where are you? Or the first question put to the first murderer, where's your brother? And what have you done? In this case, metaphysics is not about, you know, philosophical head scratching and in indulging in the luxury of arguing over abstractions. It has very concrete implications, ramifications. It affects how we understand our relationship to the other human being, not just to the Jews. This, where is your brother and what have you done, is the Jewish question that the Nazis were trying to resolve by obliterating it. So, thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, we have time for some questions for Dr. Patterson. Who would like to start? Who would?
Okay.
Please give your they get a few statements and then get the question.
Okay. Hannah Arendt, the banality of evil. Can you just speak to what that means, and if you can, if that's not another.
I can oversimplify that. Has anybody read Eichmann in Jerusalem?
Long ago.
The book is controversial not only because of the subtitle, The Banality of Evil, but because she goes easy on Eichmann and very hard on Jews, especially Jews from the East, like Hausner. The German Jewish judges she loves. The Polish Jews, like Diener, she has contempt for. That's part of the controversy in the Jewish world surrounding Hannah Arendt. But banality of evil, it's disturbing and often misunderstood in my view. If it means that ordinary people can come to do horrific things, that's a point that should be taken seriously. If it's a way of dismissing Eichmann as a nobody, as somebody who's not particularly talented or intelligent, that's something else. Eichmann claimed that he was reading the Critique of Practical Reason, you know, the whole time he's organizing train schedules for content study. Eichmann was not stupid. He wasn't highly educated. He didn't have a doctorate degree. But he wasn't stupid. And to dismiss him as stupid or as uninteresting or as just some ordinary guy doing his job is a form of Holocaust denial, I think. It's a way of avoiding this kind of question. It's a way of trivializing or minimizing or just closing off the event itself. A much better, if you're interested in reading an account of the Eichmann trial by someone who was there, Hannah Arendt was only there for like 6 or 7 days. It's a book called Facing the Glass Booth by Chaim Gouri, G-O-U-R-I. It's a better, much better book.
Sure.
I've always had difficulty understanding what makes anti-Semitism. Why is there anti-Semitism? Can you hear me?
Yeah, pull it closer.
Okay, it seems like to me you did express that American racism is different from the racism that was experienced in Europe. So, where is this kernel, where is the seed for this to have begun in the first place? Are we saying evil is a Western thing, and it's not an Eastern thing, and only evil exists in Western culture, but you know, I'm assuming it doesn't exist in Eastern cultures because they not had a Holocaust or something saying, you're evil and you must be exterminated.
It's it's different. It's not as though nothing bad ever happened in the heat.
Yeah.
I know you're not suggesting that.
Well, I'm just...
I mean, the rape of Nanking, you know, if you read some of the studies of what the Japanese did in Nanking,
Pol Pot.
I mean, there's some very... Mao, there's some very horrific events there. But Esther, what is behind that anti-Semitism? I wrote a book called Anti-Semitism and Its Metaphysical Origins. And my argument, basically, is that anti-Semitism has its roots in the most fundamental temptation or longing in the human being, which is to be like God. Eat this fruit and you will be like God. And as long as there's a Jew around, the Jew's telling me, you're not like God. The Jew's telling me, the matter of redemption is not settled. The Jew is telling me, there's no possible for purity, no possibility for purity for you. In other words, the Jew is unsettling. The Jew undermines all the utopian formulas that I have. So all the totalitarian systems, like Stalinism or Hitlerism, are anti-Semitic. They have to be. A way of thinking that situates me at the center as self-legislating has to be at least anti-Judaic, if not anti-Semitic. And there are degrees of it. It's not like either you're an anti-Semite or you're not. I mean, on my view, the kernel of anti-Semitism abides in all of us. It's not just we versus they. The anti-Semite I have to be very concerned about is me. Even if I'm Jewish. Maybe especially if I'm Jewish. So it's about getting rid of God. It's about getting rid of infinite responsibility. It's about getting rid of this question, where is your brother? What have you done? I'd rather watch the game and have a beer. I don't want to deal with it.
So you're saying, and I just keep up, anti-Semitism is based on the fact that someone looks at a Jew and says, well, the Jews are saying you can't be holy because only Jews can be holy.
No.
Is that what? I mean,
it's not that you can't be holy because only Jews can be holy. You can't be holy because you're a human being and you're bound and you screw up. We screw up. I mean, the Jews are going to have a day of atonement here in a few days precisely because Jews screw up.
Right.
Jews aren't holy. So chosen, to be chosen, what is chosen? Chosen means being assigned, being summoned and commanded. And the assignment is to be a witness to the chosenness of every human. Chosen not for privilege, but for responsibility. And it's a responsibility that cannot be met. It's a debt that can never be paid. In fact, the debt increases in the measure that I pay it. The more I respond, the more responsible I become. And that's what I don't want to hear. It keeps me awake. And I will kill somebody who robs me of my sleep.
Okay, question back here.
Oh.
Okay,
I'm a Jewish woman, and what's important always is children, right? And they take away our children. Well, look what's happening in the Trump administration. Taking away the children from the Latino, they feel as strong as we Jews. I can't think of anything worse.
Well, yeah, children are important in every human tradition. I mean, the Jews aren't unique in, you know, in valuing their children. Each tradition has its own way of articulating that. That's problematic, but that doesn't mean that it's like the Holocaust. Children weren't put in camps. They were killed. There were no camps with children in them. I mean, you can find here and there a child, but they were killed on arrival. So it's not the same.
No,
it's problematic, but it's not the same. Yeah.
I had a question myself about the Holocaust as it respects the problem of evil and the problem of suffering with an omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, benevolent God. And how do you wrestle with that trauma of evil in the context of the Holocaust?
Well, if you, in my view, the last thing you want to do is get rid of God, because if you get rid of God, then there's no problem. There's no evil. It's just what I find disturbing or unpleasant. Elie Wiesel tells a story of when he and other prisoners in the camp put God on trial for abandoning the covenant. Right. We've tried to maintain our end of the Torah. Where are you? And as they're about to find God guilty for breaking the covenant, one of them says, wait a minute, we've got to stop now. It's time for the afternoon prayers. So, I think it's, first of all, the project of trying to justify God, you know, theodicy, is completely wrong-headed. From a Jewish standpoint, God doesn't want to be justified. God wants us to have a problem with it. Because having a problem with it is an indication that we care about what happens to human beings. It's if we don't have a problem with it that we have a problem. So, and this is the word Israel means he who wrestles with, struggles with God. As Elie Wiesel said, Elie Wiesel remained a Hasid, identified himself as a very religious Jew. And I knew him personally to be very religiously observant till the end of his life. So sometimes the one who's closest to God is the one who is wrestling with God. I mean, those of you who were wrestlers in high school know that you get really, really close to somebody when you wrestle. God doesn't want us to be okay with it. God wants us to argue with him. According to Jewish teaching, the first conversation with Abraham after sealing the covenant of circumcision is an argument over Sodom and Gomorrah. It's the only time you hear God talk, thinking to himself, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm going to do? He tells him, he wants Abraham to object. So the problem of evil, evil is a problem only if there's a God that you can have a problem with. Right?
So you don't buy the process theologian's thought that God is not omnipotent?
That's not Jewish. Judaism doesn't speak, or the Hebrew Bible doesn't speak of omnipotence or omniscience. Those aren't Hebrew words. I mean, the Talmud says that everything is in God's hands except the fear of heaven. But if that's left in my hands, a whole lot of stuff can go really wrong. You can't coerce the relationship. If you coerce it, it's not a relationship. But having said all that, frankly, I'm not comfortable with all that. I mean, the question for me is, what is to be done? How do we answer, here I am for you, to someone who calls out to us? God is God's business, to me. It is my personal conviction, but it does matter, in an absolute sense, how I treat my neighbor. God wants to know, not if I like him, but where is my brother and what have I done?
Question right here. The metaphysical underpinnings you describe, to what degree do you consider them authentically within the German idealistic tradition versus a distortion of that tradition, you know, kind of like Charles Manson, you know, heard the White Album telling, you know, to murder these people? I mean, is it a distortion, or is it the authentic part of the German idealistic philosophy?
That's a good question. I should hasten to say, I don't think Kant was a Nazi. Hegel was not a Nazi. The Nazis were Nazis. Not Kant, not Hegel, not Nietzsche, not Luther, not those. Not every anti-Semite is a Nazi. I do know from my own studies that the philosophers of German idealism had varying degrees of contempt for Judaism. Because Jews, religious Jews, follow commandments that come from beyond, not from their own reasoning. If I'm Walter Schulze, you know, at the 1939, and I want to find some quote from Kant to put into my anti-Semitic speech, I can find one. But that doesn't make Kant a rabid anti-Semite. The point here is that there are a couple of points. Number one, philosophy is not an innocuous business. It has ramifications. What starts out as some philosopher's head scratching two generations later is a way of life. So if you're interested in philosophy, we who are interested in philosophy have to take great care with our thinking, with our words, and how we understand the ramifications of it. The second thing is that it's to see, and there's lots of other, I mean, it's very complicated, but it's one part of a big context for the emergence of National Socialism. It doesn't come out of nowhere. I mean, I could spend a long time on the history of Christian anti-Semitism. Never mind philosophy. And then, you know, economic factors, social factors, race theory, there are all kinds of things go in to create the perfect storm here. But I am suggesting philosophy's in the mix. And those of us who have an interest in philosophy have a responsibility to address that. Again, I'm not saying Kant was a Nazi. You can still love Kant. It's okay. Or Hegel, or Feuerbach, or, you know. I'm just saying that, you know, how we think has an impact on what happens in the world.
Question over here.
Yeah, you mentioned, okay, Kant, not a Nazi, Wagner, and then the use of the Nordic, the myth, these ancient myths that Odin and Woden, these ancient, and the characters that emerged in Wagner's opera, like you said, bringing out this folk, this thing that's almost genetic, in people that don't even know the difference between anti-Semitism and not. Was that all like deliberate? I mean, like, how did it happen?
Okay, let's keep in mind that the time frame, Wagner died in 1881, I believe. The question of the Jews standing in civil society came to the forefront with the French Revolution and the aftermath, the revolutions of 1848, the Jewish question is reintroduced. Can Jews hold political office? Can Jews attend universities? Can Jews, you know, assimilate? So in this century of the rise of nationalism, you've got this, this is not just Germany, but you have this alien national presence. You've got the presence of a nation without a state. The Jews. So the Jews, as an alien presence within the body of the folk or the body politic, the nationalistic body, the Jew is like a bacterium. So to the extent that my national identity becomes more and more central to my identity as a human, the Jew becomes more and more threatening to my national identity. Now, all nationalism has a strong mythological dimension. It has to. The epic poetry. It has, nationalism is not just politics. It's also, you could argue, religion or spiritual. The word Geist is thrown around all the time. So the Jew, in the general social, cultural, political discourse, nationalistic discourse in Europe at the time, the Jew is the threat. So it's not by chance that Wagner sees the Jew as a threat. He's not alone in that. But what Wagner, what one of the great greatness of Wagner is the way he, through his art and his music, he breathes life into these mythological figures. And it's a very powerful, deep, emotional attraction for many, many, many people.
Time for one more question right back here.
Sorry, but I oversimplified.
Okay, two other things. The first one is, I looked for historical parallels. I noticed that certain groups of individuals, certain class of people, targeted as physical manifestations of symbolic ideological beliefs. For example, in Stalinism, kulaks, the class of kulaks, they were liquidated because they were the class enemy and according to the Nazi
party.
Second group, within Judeo-Christianity itself, the idolaters are identified as a group to be eliminated wholly or partially because they're the ideological beliefs.
Well, the Kulak, you're referring to the Holodomor of 1933,
34. And also, like, the Khmer Rouge eliminated their classes. Just
yes. Yes. The class enemy is largely a political threat, a power threat. And they're visible. They're not ubiquitous. They're not, you don't have to go to the Arctic to find them and kill them. It's enough to kill all of them in the Ukraine. Or in Khmer Rouge, or where, Rwanda, or. And each of those genocides has its own character and its own driving forces. So, to say it's not the same is not to say it doesn't matter. Right, or shouldn't be studied. Not saying that at all. As far as the idolaters and there are seven tribes in the land that the Israelites are commanded to eliminate. They're also commanded to make peace with the other tribes, or to try to make peace with the other tribes. But the seven are identified because they're the ones who pass their children through fire. They engage in child sacrifice, which is an indication of a presence of evil. You should have a problem with that. Believe me, as I tell my students, the rabbis have thought of every question you can think of. They have. So the Talmudic sages and whatnot, they're troubled by this too, but the reason that the killing is troubling is because of the 20th chapter of Exodus. If you get rid of the whole thing, then the killing is not a problem. It's the divine prohibition that makes the killing a problem. That puts you in a position of, why are we doing this? How can we be commanded to do this? Are we sure we're being commanded to do this? So, as Elie Wiesel mentions, that while most of the Bible is poetry, the book of Joshua has no poetry. Because where people are dying, there must be no poetry. No song. Yeah. So
my second question is that I kind of disagree with you a little bit on the idea that Nazism, the ego, the personal ego versus using the external, coming out external. My reading of it is it's the sort of twisted Darwinism guided by providence. This is the way that the Nazis described. But it's the laws of nature, twisted laws, but it's external. It's not the individual of Nazis, their willpower, it's the will of providence guiding nature, of strong areas versus evil and wicked as a sort of a net law of nature rather than, and they're just following the law of nature rather than their own individual ego.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word providence because the Nazis were not anti-religion. They were religious.
That's the word they
used. Yeah. So they have a sense of destiny, calling, and it comes with all the trappings of religious discourse, religious rites and rituals. So if it's Darwinism, it's Darwinism raised to, or twisted into a level that Darwin never took it to be.
Right. Yeah. But it's not individual ego will, it's the will of nature and external.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same way the communist pseudoscientific class.
Well, but it's in the light of that natural providence, or the providence that, I have to bring to bear my own will. Right. The triumph, the famous Nazi propaganda film Triumph of the Will has a lot of examples of the individual heroic overcoming of things like conscience. One of the things that Hitler blamed the Jews for was that the Jews invented conscience. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you can see there's a lot to talk about, and I appreciate all the questions and comments and ideas, and thanks for coming out.
Let's give another round of applause.